What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday afternoon. A little reference to the Moody Blues there. It is a program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, we are here to get that question answered. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And of course, you can always send us an email 24/7. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles is our producer, Matt Kabinski handling the phones. Rich Jesse is on social media. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the chat screen, if you would, please. Rich will see that. He will copy-paste it, send it to us here in the studio, and off we go. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, my friend?
You know, I'm doing all right. Thank you.
Interesting question here. This came in a couple of days ago via YouTube. We didn't have time to get to it on our Friday show, so here we go. This is from Barb, and this is regarding Jesus' sacrifice. Can you please clarify 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21 for me? I've never understood it. 2 Corinthians 5:21.
Absolutely. I'm just going to pull it up and read it for the audience's sake. Here we go. 2 Corinthians 5. Okay, 21. Here we go. Yes, God made him who had no sin to be for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Now, there is a common misinterpretation of this passage given by Reformed, Calvinist, and other Protestant theologians that treat this as though it were a proof text for the doctrine of the imputation of Christ's righteousness. So let me tell you what that is and why this is not that. Okay, so a key component in Calvinist soteriology, the Calvinist doctrine of salvation, is the idea that that our sins were imputed to Christ, that God regarded Jesus as if he had committed our sins. And so when Christ died on the cross, God was literally punishing Jesus for sins that Jesus himself did not commit. And that in turn, Jesus' righteous deeds are imputed to the believer so that God counts the believer as if he had done the righteous deeds that Jesus had done, and the believer is in consequence rewarded for things he did not do. So you have God who punishes the innocent and acquits and rewards the guilty through this this legal exchange, which in any other context we would regard as the supreme act of injustice. I mean, imagine if one of these recent political assassins, if the judge said, I've got a really good idea. My nephew has a son and he's never done anything wrong. So why don't we send him to prison for life and we'll let the murderer go scot-free and instead we'll, give him a plaque for good behavior or something.
Wow.
We would say, well, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard in my life. That's manifest injustice. But that's what this view imputes to God. It's exactly that kind of a transaction, right?
All right.
Catholics don't believe that. And we don't think that's what's in view in 2 Corinthians 5. So the context of 2 Corinthians in this passage, mm-hmm, is the ministry of the apostles, and Paul is always contending that he is in fact an apostle, and that was called in question by some of his contemporaries because he had not been one of the 12, right? And he makes the case that he really is an apostle, and that the righteousness of God in this context refers to God's faithfulness to his covenant promises. And Paul is arguing that the apostolic ministry, Paul's apostolic ministry, is the manifestation of God's fidelity to his covenant promises. So in particular, the Old Testament prophets had said that in the coming kingdom of God, one of the signs of the coming kingdom of God will be this massive influx of Gentiles into the covenant community. And that is exactly what Paul thought his job description was as an apostle. His job was to be the means of fulfilling the prophecy that Gentiles would come to God. And then he in turn would point to the fruits of his ministry and say, here is proof positive that Jesus Christ is the Messiah and the fulfillment of prophetic expectation. The thing we were looking for was the ingathering of Gentiles. What do you think I'm doing with my time? I'm doing nothing but gathering Gentiles all day long. And in Romans chapter 15, he speaks of the same calling, and he says, I'm a priest. I have a priestly office, and my job as a priest is to configure a sacrifice. That's what priests do. They make sacrifices, is to effect a sacrifice. And the sacrifice in this case is the sacrifice of Gentiles. I'm literally gathering them up to give them to God as an offering, right? That is my job. So this absolutely controls Paul's thinking. And so Christ's death on the cross effectuates Paul's ministry as an apostle, and his outreach to the Gentile world is the manifestation of God's righteousness, i.e. God's fidelity to his covenant promise. Hence, he has become the righteousness of God. It's got nothing to do with the doctrine of imputation for my personal accountability before God as if I somehow got off scot-free for sin. That's just nothing in the context is about that. And you have to act like, okay, in a sustained argument on one topic, all of a sudden Paul is going to reference something that he's never, ever talked about before, right, and that has nothing to do with the context, just because that fits the exigencies of my strange metaphysical theory about the death of Christ. It's just not what it means.
Wow. And yet, people still can get that confused.
Yeah. So, you know, there is a within Protestantism, you know, because of this business of sola scriptura, the Bible alone being authority, this is getting off of Paul, but one thing I've noticed is, you know, preachers will and public speakers will just drop Bible verses like with no connection to one another in sequence. And they kind of wow people with their rhetorical ability to cite texts. And it's impressive rhetorically, but they like have absolutely nothing to do with the topic under consideration when you consider them in context.
Sure. Barb, thanks so much for your question. Lots more straight ahead on this Tuesday afternoon edition of Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Glad you're with us. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. We have two lines open, 833-288-3986. Have you seen the Mother Angelica Memorial? It is on our website. It is fantastic. Dedicated to our foundress, Mother Angelica, you can celebrate her remarkable life. This great website filled with photos, milestones, heartfelt stories, and of course her wit and words that have inspired the hearts of all ages throughout the years. Visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica. Check out the memorial right there, EWTN.com/Mother Angelica. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Camille in New Jersey, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hello, Camille. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I hope you hear me.
Yes.
Say something, because I think I just... Can you hear me now?
Yeah,
you sound fine. Go ahead, Camille.
Oh, okay. I'm wondering if... I don't know how to phrase this, but... I was talking about the Bible with a friend, and she was telling me that, you know, the Catholic Church, let me think about this, removed the two books of the Book of Thomas and the Book of Mary, and I've never heard of this before, so I'm just wondering if there's any truth to that, or what the story is behind that, the history.
Sure.
I figured
Absolutely.
You would know, Doctor.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So first of all, the idea that the Catholic that there was some kind of some sort of proto canon of the Bible, some sort of, you know, pre canon that was circulated as a unit that was authoritative in Christian circles, that was, you know, a more or less coherent collection, and that the Catholic Church sneakily came by and, you know, with a maniacal look on its face, extended its slimy claws and said, he, we will pull out the two books we don't like, ha, 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 and hide them under the bed covers. And then the people wake up the next morning and say, hey, where did I two books go? You know, I mean, that is just an utterly fictive view of how the biblical text came into being. Okay, so let me first of all give you a little history on the formation of the canon. So when Christ grows from the dead, before he ascended to heaven, he sent the apostles into the four corners of the world to make disciples with the command that they were to teach everything that he had commanded them, which, of course, was all oral, and Jesus, you know, left us no written testament to his ministry. So the church existed for, a good... a couple of decades before the first Christian texts were ever written, and that we know anything about. Okay,
right.
And the earliest Christian texts that we know of are the letters of St. Paul, and most scholars think the first book that we have anything to, and this is not, I'm not talking about biblical books, I'm just talking about books.
Yeah.
Like Christian writings of any kind, right? With letters of Paul, and they, you know, probably got cranking in the 40s or 50s, and Paul was dead by around 65, and so you would have had Paul's letters, you know, composed over a, you know, 10 or 15 year period in there, okay? The earliest Gospels we know anything about, the Gospel of Mark, in most likelihood, probably composed around 70 AD, you know, give or take a few years in one direction or the other. Matthew and Luke show a good bit of dependence on Mark, so they're later. And then most scholars would place the Gospel of John someplace around 90 AD to maybe 100 AD. There are some other texts that begin to appear and get circulated from the end of the first century, so and the beginnings of the second century. So there's a there's a book called the Didache that was a work of church discipline and liturgy that was around that time period. There are a number of letters from early church bishops, Ignatius of Antioch, Polycarp, the martyrdom of Polycarp. There are other works of ecclesiastical discipline and so forth that begin to get circulated. There are some apocalyptic texts that don't exist in the Bible, like the Shepherd Hermas is one of them. There was an early bishop of Rome after St. Peter named Clement, and Clement wrote at least one authentic letter, sometimes called First Clement. There's also a Second Clement in circulation that most scholars think Clement probably did not write. Interestingly, First Clement is written to the church in Corinth, the same church that Paul had written to, and Clement is kind of like, hey guys, I thought Paul straightened you folks out, but you still need some straightening out. What's with all this trouble that I'm hearing about, you know? So there's some serious continuity going on there. The Polycarp correspondence is a little bit connected to the Johannine community, the community around the Gospel of John. And so there's continuity between some of these books and early Christian leaders and the apostles and so forth. I could name a lot of other texts that emerge. Now, when you get later... We begin to discover some other texts that are later than what are now the canonical Gospels that claim to be Gospels. They're accounts of the life of Christ and the apostles. Many of them are anonymous. Some of them are just lists of sayings. One of those is the Gospel of Thomas. One of those is the Gospel of Eric. Thomas is just, there's no narrative in the Gospel of Thomas. It's just a list of sayings. It's just a list of sayings, which shows some overlap with the canonical Gospels and some differences as well. And then there are other texts, and so they're all kind of floating around there in circulation, and some of them you only find in maybe one region of the world. Okay, so the Gospel of Thomas, you tend to find in Syria. Right?
Syria,
yeah,
really?
Exactly.
Okay.
The only manuscripts we have for some of these other Gospels, like the Gospel of Mary, they come in a Coptic edition. The papyri that we have discovered that archaeologists have found date to like the 4th and 5th century. So dating the actual composition is very difficult. There was a cache of text that did not have a wide circulation in ancient Christianity that was kind of all discovered at one time. And this is, these are all very modern discoveries, and so you'll see scholars like Elaine Pagels will publish books on, you know, quote-unquote, the Gnostic Gospels. Many of them have reference to this cache of texts that was found in Egypt. So, but again, the fact that there are lots of different books, I mean, like, if I, you know, if I open up the New York Times review of books, well, they list a lot of books, right, that people are reading. The fact that there are a lot of books that some particular audience is reading does not constitute evidence that the reading public considers that list as a list to be a coherent authority of its own, right? I mean, like, if John Grisham writes a book and Betty Crocker writes a new cookbook, I don't stick them together and go, oh, the canon of the Third Testament of Grisham and Betty Crocker. I mean, they obviously don't belong together, right? You know?
Yeah.
And the process of actually collecting them together into something like a canonical list is another step of development, right? Now let's look how this cashes out with the New Testament. So when the way we do this as scholars is we say, okay, when were Christians referencing these texts as if they came to us from God, or at the very least, treating them as authorities to which the church is owed some sort of allegiance?
Okay, uh-huh.
The letters of Paul were very early, and no doubt they were authoritative in Pauline churches, but not all churches acknowledged Paul back in the first century. So the earliest evidence that there were texts that were sort of universally acknowledged as authoritative, you begin to get some references to the four Gospels in the second century, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Okay.
Right? You get references to those collections like as a thing, right? You know, I mean, St. Irenaeus, who's a second century bishop in Lyon, actually comes up with a really strange argument for why there have to be exactly four Gospels, not more, not less. I'm not persuaded by his argument, but the fact is he's talking about the fact that there are four of them,
okay,
right? And he's not saying there's eight of them or there's two of them or whatever. And so you begin to get some references to, you know, to the four Gospels as a thing, like as a unit. And in 2 Peter, the New Testament book of 2 Peter, you get references to the letters of St. Paul as a thing, like the indication that people were passing around the Pauline corpus as a distinct collection, right? You still don't have a New Testament, right? You've got the Gospels, you have the letters of Paul, and other New Testament books that are in circulation.
Yeah, yeah.
And then actually it was a non-Catholic, it was a guy that was ultimately sort of cast out of the church for being a heretic because, among other things, he believed in two gods, and he believed that the God of the Old Testament was evil, and he thought that the world was made out of matter and spirit. He had all kinds of, you know, strange beliefs. His name is Marcion, and Marcion really hated the Old Testament. He hated Jews, and so he wanted to excise, he actually did want to take books, as it were, out of the Bible, right? And I failed to mention the Old Testament because everybody kind of acknowledged the Old Testament in the Septuagint.
Uh-huh.
Marcion said, hey, I'm going to come up with a list of books people should read, and it's going to be not the Old Testament. I'm getting rid of the Old Testament. The letters of Paul and portions of the Gospel of Matthew that I think are okay.
Wow.
And so the you have Marcion's canon of the Bible, which was constructed around his particular interpretation of Christianity, is likely the beginning of the idea of, I'm going to give you the definitive list of books. Problem was, Marcion's canon, which did not, by the way, include the Gospel of Thomas or these other things, Marcion's canon was clearly wrong. I mean, for other reasons, it threw out the entire Old Testament. And so you begin to get church fathers that say, well, hold on a second now, Marcion. No, we need these other books in there too. And so now you start to get debates about which books are authoritative, okay? What does not emerge in those discussions is, well, you know, we all just have the Gospel of Mary and Thomas, you know, like in our back pocket, and we've taught it in Sunday school for years, and that's what everybody has to preach from. Like, that's not part of the discussion. You
okay.
Follow me?
Yes,
like, this is not, you're not finding this in the dialogue at all. And you're mainly getting debates about the Gospels, the letters of Paul. Those are pretty much the givens. And then, you know, what when I was in seminary, we called them the extras, you know, which is like everything else in the New Testament, you know, Hebrews and the Petrine epistles and the Johannine epistles and the book of Revelation. And then, you know, I still scratch my head sometimes and wonder how Jude ever made it into the Bible. You know, but these other books are the extras, you know. And then it's not until you get to the fourth century that you get a bishop who gives you a list and says, here are the books of the New Testament. And the Bishop Athanasius, who was Egyptian, he was from Alexandria, writes a letter. It's called Athanasius' Easter Letter, and he lists the 27 books of the canonical New Testament that we now recognize. And then later the councils of Carthage and Hippo in Rome, also 4th century councils, confirmed that list as well as the Old Testament canon. And again, what you do find disputes over some New Testament texts. Like, there were fathers that did not think Revelation should be in there. It was not a real popular book with some. Hebrews was controversial because it doesn't have an author attached to it, right? Second Peter, when I was in seminary, my seminary professor said, Second Peter is the only book in the Bible that actually gains in translation.
Wow.
Because the Greek is really bad. It's like not good Greek. First Peter has pretty good Greek. Second Peter has pretty poor Greek. So there are some fathers that are like, really? We're going to let Second Peter in there? But, you know, but it snuck in. It snuck in. But again, Thomas, Mary, you know, some of these other, I mean, they were popular books by, with some, but they really weren't under discussion. And so it's a false picture to suggest that those texts were somehow widely disseminated and recognized as part of something called the Bible that the Catholic Church sneakily went in and pulled out. They were peculiar texts, peculiar to set communities, some of them obviously Gnostic in their belief. There were guys similar to Marcion, but not Marcion.
Uh-huh.
You know, there were communities that the Catholic Church said, well, you know, you guys misunderstand the gospel because, among other things, we don't believe that there are two gods. These people did, you know. And they had alternate views of how salvation happens. It seemed to conflict with the canonical gospels, which were the earlier texts. And so, yeah, these texts do exist. There are thousands and thousands of books. I mean, you can pull up Amazon and look up, you know, books about Jesus, and you will find some of the wildest stuff on the planet, right? Did the Catholic Church pull them out of the Bible? They were never in the Bible, right? I mean, they're just people making up stuff about Jesus all the time. It happened in the antiquity too.
Camille, is that helpful for you?
Yeah, I just remembered something. Thank you so much, Doctor, for all that information. It's very good. But she mentioned something about finding her truth, right? Her truth in with the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah.
That's what she's going on. And I said, you know what? There's a lot of books about the Dead Sea Scrolls. So like you're saying, it's, I don't know. So, okay.
Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls is something completely different. The Dead Sea Scrolls has nothing to do with the New Testament. Dead Sea Scrolls, well, I mean, there are no texts of the New Testament in the Dead Sea Scrolls, put it that way. Dead Sea Scrolls is a cache of texts that were Old Testament texts and other Second Temple Jewish texts. And the Catholic Church thinks the Dead Sea Scrolls are pretty awesome. We've learned a lot about ancient Judaism in the context of early Christianity. In fact, John Bergsma, who's a Catholic biblical scholar, has a great book on the Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, about the significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls for understanding the New Testament, the life of Jesus in the context of the early church, that I recommend to you. Go pick up John Bergsma's book, The Dead Sea Scrolls, Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. I got no problem with the Dead Sea Scrolls, but again, that's got nothing to do with the question of Gospel of Thomas and Gospel of Mary. Another book you might be interested in is Henry Graham's book, Where We Got the Bible, Debt to the Catholic Church, which does kind of give you a good history of the canon.
Well, there you go. Camille, thanks so much for your call today. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. We have several lines open for you, 833-288-3986. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177, 58177, or send us an email, ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we'll be talking with Stephen in the Woodlands in Texas. We also will hopefully get to your call as well. Again, that number 833-288-EWTN. We're at the halfway point here, so we've got time enough for your call. 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Glad you're with us for the Tuesday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for your call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-398-3986. Couple lines open for you right now. Hey, congratulations to another EWTN radio partner, Archangel Radio, serving Mobile, Alabama and all that area, now celebrating 15 years with us. Congratulations to Ellen Taylor and her team there at WNGL AM and FM from your friends here at EWTN. Got to see Ellen a couple of weeks ago at the EWTN affiliates meeting.
Great.
That we had in Washington, D.C. area. That was very nice. She's very dedicated to Catholic radio, as are we. All right, back to the phones now for Stephen in the Woodlands in Texas, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio. Stephen, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, good afternoon, Dr. Anders. I was going through Twitter, and I see a lot of news information about certain bishops around the country that are shutting down the traditional Latin Mass in certain dioceses, and
yep.
I was just wondering, what's the purpose of that?
Yeah, thank you. So Pope Francis issued a motu proprio, and that's a legal document in the Catholic arsenal that means by the Pope's own authority. So he just sends down a legal decision that is then the law of the Church that required all the bishops in the Latin Rite to place certain restrictions on the use of the traditional Latin Mass, or the Mass according to the Council of Trent. And the Pope was pretty clear about his reasons, and he gave several, but I'll quote the one that I think is most relevant and the one that has gotten the most press. Pope Francis wrote, he says, "A final reason for my decision is this. Ever more plain in the words and attitudes of many," and he's talking about many people who are adherents of the traditional Latin Mass, "is the close connection between the choice of celebrations according to the liturgical books prior to Vatican Council II, i.e., okay, there's a connection for the choice of the Latin Mass, and the rejection of the Church and her institutions in the name of what is called, quote, the true Church." So let me unpack that for you, okay? The Pope is saying that there are some people who are rejecting the actual empirical Catholic Church, that is to say, the Church of the Pope and the bishops in communion with him,
mm-hmm.
in view of an ideological construct that they call the true Church. So not the empirical Church of the Pope and the bishops, but a kind of, you know, utopian or golden age imagined church, the church of their imagination, that they, you know, they confute with, you know, some idealized reconstruction of Catholic history, and that in view of their loyalty to that thing, rather than to, say, the actual living, breathing, infleshed Holy Father in Rome, right, in this case, Francis,
uh-huh.
and the bishops in communion with him, and that the symbol of that adherence, the rejection of the one and the embrace of the other, the symbol of that adherence is in fact their adherence to the Latin Mass as such, right? And so it is basically a schismatical act, and potentially also a heretical doctrine that is implied, a heretical doctrine of the Church, but at the very least an act of schism, which is a rejection of the authority of the Holy Father. And the Latin Mass is the Vatican II here becomes the big bugbear, like in the theory it's like supposedly the point of rupture from the quote unquote true Church, and so they justify their rejection of, you know, the Vatican Council, the reform of the Mass after the Council and the sitting Holy Father, in preference to this allegedly true Church. Now, let's make a couple comments about that. Does Francis's construction of events correspond to any actual reality? I contend that it does, right? And the reason I contend that is that I've met people who hold exactly the position that the Pope rejects, right? I have met people who have told me, I go to the Latin Mass because I reject the authority of Pope Francis. And I've heard that exact concept articulated. I have heard people tell me I go to the Latin Mass because I regard the Second Vatican Council as essentially a rupture that broke with the quote-unquote true Church. And this is how I find my Catholic identity, is in this Mass rather than in communion with the Pope and the bishops in communion with him. So, I mean, the position the Pope has stated, I have met people who hold that opinion, all right? I've also met people who hold a kind of a watered down version of it. I remember giving a public talk one time, and we went to Q&A after the talk, and there's a certain kind of questioner in Q&As that they don't really have a question. What they have is a diatribe that they want you to validate. And, you know, it's like, Dr. Andrews, isn't it the case that blah, 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 and they want me to come in and go, oh, yes, of course, right? So this fellow stands up and he says, Dr. Andrews, given that the prayers of the Latin Mass are so much more intrinsically efficacious than those of the Novus Ordo, what can we as Catholics do to promote the wider acceptance of the Latin Mass? And I said, well, I understand the question. I disagree with the premise, right? I disagree with the premise that merely reciting the prayers of the traditional Latin Mass necessarily means that God is more likely to answer them. And that is exactly what this guy was asserting, right? Now, he wasn't saying, I regard the Novus Ordo Mass as illegitimate. He was saying, I regard it as less effective, right? But so like I said, this is kind of like a watered-down version of the same schismatic theory. Now, if you really believed that, if you believe that there were two masses and one worked well and one works, you know, one is like, you know, the brand new high trim model, you know, although in this case, I guess it would be the old high trim model. And then you have like, you know, the Yugo mass, right? You know, you're going to go for the Cadillac mass if that's what the reality is. Okay. So that's a watered down version of this. All right. So that really does exist. Now there is, there's dispute. There are bishops who dispute this. There are a lot of Catholic scholars and lay people who say, yeah, but Francis, how widespread is this attitude? How widespread? That question is in dispute, all right? And there are clearly people who do not hold those heretical or schismatic attitudes. There are people who say, you know, I happen to like the Catholic Mass. I mean, you know, I think it was Duke Ellington said that there are, you know, there are two kinds of music, good kind and the other kind, you know, and people are like that with their aesthetic judgments. You know, I mean, I just happen to know that you know, the classic rock of the early 70s is like the best popular music ever written.
Duh.
And it's like all downhill from there in both directions. But the problem is my mother just also really knows that the best popular music ever written was everything she listened to on the radio, you know, at her, you know, jitterbug dances in the 1950s.
Oh man!
Right, and it's all downhill from there. You know, and there is such a thing as an aesthetic preference that just smacks me as patently obvious. But I mean, I'm not really going to say that if you like the other kind of music that you're somehow, you know, like a bad person or you don't know God or anything like that. And so there can be a legitimate aesthetic preference or a devotional preference to some form of prayer. And to cultivate that, because this helps me get closer to God or my family or what have you, or, you know, the community we've built around this is tight-knit and we enjoy that and experience, you know, a certain kind of commonality and camaraderie and so forth. I mean, these are legitimate values and they're not to be despised. And so there is a dispute about, okay, well, how much of it is the one and how much of it is the other, right? But that's the nature of the controversy.
Okay.
And that's the reason the Pope restricted the Mass. It remains to be seen what Pope Leo's attitude will be towards this. He has gotten a lot of requests from bishops and the faithful around the world to repeal or to at least amend the motu proprio Traditionis Custodis, and I guess we'll have to wait and see how that cashes out.
Stephen, thanks so much for your call today from the Woodlands in Texas. It is Called to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Michael in Metairie, Louisiana, listening on the great Catholic Community Media. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hello, David. How are you?
You know, I'm getting along. How about you?
Great, great. Especially when I listen to you. I have to congratulate you. I've been listening for about a year or so. And I have never seen, I'm a federal trial lawyer for over 40 years, and I have never seen anybody with persuasiveness of yours.
I missed my calling. I should have been a lawyer.
You definitely did. If I walk into a federal court and see you on the other side, I'd run out the back door.
Well, tell my son in law school that, okay, you know.
And you are the son of an attorney.
I've got an attorney father and an attorney son, but I somehow missed the family business.
Oh, you're in good shape. My family's attorneys too. But anyway, we had a fortunate occurrence about 20 years ago. We were at the Vatican Library, and they were showing a rare exhibit to the public of the Codex Vaticanus.
Yeah.
It was inspirational.
Wonderful.
But anyway, I have two... Sorry?
Yes, that's wonderful. Great. But go ahead. What's your question?
Yeah, we got two quick questions. Number one, in the scripture, it says that the angels don't know and Jesus doesn't know, but the Father only knows when Jesus will come back. Does that intimate that Jesus is a little lower than the Father and that he doesn't have that knowledge?
Okay, so I'm going to answer two questions there. One is about Christ's knowledge, and the other is the question of Christ's inferiority, supposed to the Father. So obviously, if you hold the Orthodox doctrine concerning Christology in the hypostatic union, you have to conclude that in virtue of his divinity, Christ is omniscient, right? Christ is omniscient, knows all things.
Yeah.
In virtue of his divinity. But remember, the doctrine of the Incarnation teaches that the second person assumed a human nature that's fully human. I mean, that means it's human all up and down. I mean, you know, if there's anything that's characteristic or essential to human nature as such, then the person Jesus has got that, you know, qua human, okay? Now, that means that Jesus' human physiology, Jesus' human neurology would have adapted and changed the same way any human would have. And so, you know, there was a time when the humanity of Jesus had never seen written Hebrew, right? Never, but I mean, think about it, he was 3 or 4 years old. He probably hadn't picked up a text, you know, hadn't looked at a manuscript. He's never seen written Hebrew. We know he read. He went into the synagogue in Capernaum, and they handed him the scroll of Isaiah, and he reads the scroll of Isaiah. He knew how to read. I'm presuming that young baby Jesus had a tutor somehow. Maybe it was his parents. Maybe the local rabbi, who walked him through the Hebrew alphabet and taught him how to read Hebrew. And again, the process neurologically would have been the same as for any other child. The information would have hit his retina, and his ears would have been interpreted. The signals would have been interpreted by his brain. The proper lobes of the brain would have been implicated. It would have been stored in memory. However that happens is more than I know, but it would have been stored in memory in the same way. The same kind of apparatus would take place. And so you could talk about Jesus. In fact, the scriptures do talk about him growing in stature and learning and these kinds of things. The Bible uses that language of him. All that would be true of Christ as a human, right? And you know, if his brain came preloaded with Hebrew, that would not be human, right? The brain, because the brain's a physical object. The brain's a physical object, you see? And so the way Catholic theologians have always interpreted this passage is to say that Christ had no acquired knowledge of the date of his second coming. You know, he didn't learn it in Hebrew school, right? Any more than you or I learned it in Sunday school. He had no acquired knowledge. And so in that sense, the Son of Man has no knowledge of these things. Qua God, of course, he would have known all things. So
sure.
That's the way Catholic theologians handled that issue.
Okay. And you had another question, Michael?
Oh, inferiority of the Father.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So in the doctrine of the Trinity, the Catholic doctrine is that the Father is the source. He's the source of the Blessed Trinity. He is the first principle from which the Son and the Spirit proceed, right? Now, here's a question. Are you substantially, like that is to say, in your substance, or morally inferior to your Father on earth simply in virtue of being a son? Now, you know, your dad might have been a bad guy or something like that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about it, with respect to your humanity, right? Are you inferior to your Father just in virtue of having been generated by him? The answer is obviously no. The answer is obviously no, okay? But is there a relation between you and your Father where one is the source, one is the principle, and one is the generated? Yes, absolutely, right? And so there is a kind of priority with respect to Father and Son. In us, it happens to be temporal. In God, it's not temporal, where we would say, well, there's a sense in which you could say the Father is primary in the sense that he is the principle from which things proceed, right? Same kind of relationship exists between Father and Son in the Blessed Trinity. The Father is the source. He's the principle. The Son is the generated. He is the one that proceeds. But it doesn't, that doesn't necessitate, and of course does not involve, any metaphysical or moral or valuative inferiority on the part of the Son to the Father.
Okay. Michael, thanks so much for your call from Metairie. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Coming up later on this afternoon, 5 p.m. Eastern, Ave Maria in the afternoon with Dr. Marcus Peter. What a great program that is. Dr. Peter, what a phenomenal mind, a renowned biblical theologian, commentator, exploring the intersection of church, culture, and current events through the lens of faith from the heart of the church. Do check it out again today, 5 p.m. Eastern, right here on EWTN Radio. Mike is a first-time caller driving through Virginia, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hello, Dr. Anders. I was raised Catholic, been away from the church for a long, long time. My wife brought me back a few years ago. And we've done, you know, the Bible in a year study with Father Mike, and we're doing the catechism right now. There's a lot of questions, but one question that I just take it out of my mind is the part of the Bible where it says, Jesus says we're supposed to hate our mother and father. You know, God's got to be first, love God first, you don't get to heaven. And that part kind of confuses me. That may not be the right question for this show, but I just thought I'd ask. I just started listening to EWTN just yesterday, actually, first time listening to it. So
yeah, absolutely. In the Gospels, you remember when Jesus calls the disciples, particularly Peter and James. They're out in the fishing boat. They're with their dad. And Jesus comes by and says, come follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. And they do an astonishing thing. They must have known who Jesus was in some respect. You know, Peter says, away from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man. So he knew who this Jesus character was, at least by reputation. And he's shocked that Jesus shows up at the shoreline and asks him to follow him. And he says, no, come on, I'll make you fishers of men. And then we just read it and pass by like it's no big deal. It says Peter and James, they got out of the boat. They left their father and the hired help. So Peter had hired help. Their nets and their boats, and they walked after Jesus.
Boom.
And you can see Dad is in the ship, and he's like, kids, wait a minute. We got a pile of fish here. We got to sell. I mean, where are you going? And they're like, sorry, Dad, we're out of here.
Wow.
Okay. In Mark chapter 10 or 12? I think it's 10. Mark chapter 10, there's another case. There's this guy, Matthew calls him a rich young ruler, but a young man comes to Jesus and he says, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Christ says an astonishing thing to the guy. He says, why are you calling me good? You already know what to do. Go keep the commandments. And the kid says, we've already kept the commandments. What else do I need to do? Beautiful passage here. Jesus says, Mark says that Jesus looked at him and loved him. And he says, one thing you lack. Sell everything you have, give to the poor, come and follow me, and you'll gain the treasures of heaven. And unlike Peter and James, the guy says, I don't know. I don't think I'm ready to leave the family estates yet, and he goes on back. Now looks to me like Christ offered to make this guy the 13th disciple. I mean, what he says is, leave everything. That's exactly what he told James and Peter. He says, leave everything. Come follow me. And look, he did that to some other guys, and they did it.
Yeah.
They left everything, followed him, right? And this guy said, I'm not sure I'm ready to do that. And he gave up being the 13th disciple, right? Think of all the Sunday school lessons that would have to be rewritten we'd have to have 13 disciples instead of 12, you know? He gave that up.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I'm not going to do it. Did Jesus give that counsel to everybody? No, he didn't. You remember the story of the Gerasene demoniac? Gerasene demoniac's possessed by demons. He's sitting out in the rocks and hills, screaming and hitting himself with stones and carrying on like crazy. And Jesus heals the man. The guy comes to his senses and says, man, this Jesus guy is the best thing since sliced bread. I got to have more of this. And he comes to Jesus. Jesus, let me follow you. I want to join your band of merry men. You know, I want to join the band of disciples and come after you. And Jesus says, man, you've suffered way too much. You don't have to do that. Why don't you go back to your family? He sends the guy back to his family. Let's take a third case, Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is a tax collector. He's a short little guy. He climbs up in a tree to see Jesus coming down the road. Jesus is coming down the road. He stops at the base of the tree. He says, Zacchaeus, I'd like to have lunch at your house. Zacchaeus hurries down, runs in, makes lunch for Jesus, gives Jesus lunch. After lunch, it'd be interesting, wouldn't you love to have a microphone in that conversation? What did Jesus and Zacchaeus talk about? But after lunch, we know what happens. Zacchaeus hops up and he says, Jesus, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give half of my possessions to the poor. Not all, half. And I'm going to pay back, you know, with interest anybody that I've defrauded. And Jesus says, today salvation has come to this house. Three different situations, three different pieces of advice. Did he ask everybody to leave their parents in the nets and the boat and come? No. Some people he sent back to their families. Some people he seemed content for them to simply right the wrongs that they had done. Others he called to a more radical form of life, leaving everything behind. You could, in the English language, and honestly don't know enough about biblical Greek to make this nuance, in the English language, we will sometimes use the word despise to mean something other than, you know, I hate you with a fiery passion and wish a pox upon your house. We'll use the word despise to mean, you know, did not value at all in comparison with.
Okay.
You know, like Esau despised his birthright. Well, did he really despise his birthright, or he just kind of devalued it in view of the you know, the pot of lentil soup? Man, I'd love to have a bowl of that lentil soup, right? that Jacob had offered him, you know? And I think when you look at the larger context, it's evident the kind of thing that Jesus is saying here. Be like Peter and John, who are willing to leave their father in the nets and commit themselves to a radical form of life, if that's your vocation.
Yeah.
And so he definitely doesn't mean, because the rest of the context of the entire Bible makes clear, including the teaching of Jesus, he does not mean, you know, take out a contract on your father's life because he's a bad guy. Not that kind of hatred.
Okay. Very good. Mike, thanks so much for your call today. We're going to get to Kelly in just a second. A quick question from Coffee watching us on YouTube. Will you come, Dr. David Andrews, to Hong Kong? We would all welcome you to Hong Kong to share your thoughts and experiences with us.
That's a really good question. And to discuss that, I would ask that you reach out to me on my website, drdavidandrews.com.
There's a process.
There's a process. And it includes getting Jack Williams to be okay with me being away for several days to travel to Hong Kong.
Yeah.
You know? But I do travel to speak, right? And I've never had an invitation to Hong Kong. But that, I mean, I'll contemplate anything, but
sure.
You know, reach out to me at my website and we'll have a conversation.
Coffee, thanks for reaching out. Now let's go to Kelly in Michigan, listening on the EWTN app. Kelly, what's on your mind today?
Hey, now back in July 22nd was the feast day of Mary Magdalene.
Okay.
And I was a little confused because it was said that Mary Magdalene and Mary and Martha were the same Mary.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you. So there are just a bunch of Marys in the New Testament.
Yes.
You have the Blessed Virgin Mary. You have Mary Magdalene. You have Mary, the sister to Martha, from Mary of Bethany,
yeah.
Right? You have Mary, the wife of Clopas, and you have Mary, who happens to be the mother of John Mark, and at least one other Mary mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles, I think. But the ones that are most prominent in the Gospels are the Blessed Virgin Mary, Mary Magdalene, and Mary of Bethany, the sister of Martha, and then you have one reference to Mary, the wife of Clopas. So in this case, Mary Magdalene and Mary of Bethany are not the same person. There is some confusion in Catholic history over whether Mary Magdalene is the same person as the unnamed sinful woman. You know, Jesus meets a quote-unquote sinful woman who breaks a jar of expensive perfume and anoints his feet. And there was a tradition in Catholicism for a while to equate Mary Magdalene with the quote-unquote sinful woman. That's not entirely clear from the text that that's the case. So, yeah, if you were going for, you know, distinct characters that could be known by their names, you'd have to conclude that the New Testament did a really bad job writing that, which is more evidence of their historical accuracy, right? They're really, Mary was a popular name in antiquity, and there really were all these people named Mary running around.
Clearly. Hey, Kelly, thanks so much for your call today from Michigan. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
There was a question that came in earlier from Frank on YouTube. Didn't have time to get that, but Pedro's going to grab it so it doesn't get away. Oh, looks like he's already done so. Fantastic. So we'll get to that on tomorrow's program. So, Frank, be sure to join us for the beginning of tomorrow's program. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow on that Wednesday edition of Call to Communion. Until then, have a beautiful day and God bless.